There are a lot of missions that are going to the moon and Mars, trying to explore these worlds more carefully. And yet, the conditions on the surface of both the moon and Mars are brutal. You've got temperature extremes, you've got radiation that's coming from space, but there are these natural places on both of these worlds that you could go into and be partially protected from the hazards of being on the surface of the moon or Mars. And these are lava tubes. They're like the ones that we have on Earth, but because of the lower gravity, they can be gigantic, hundreds of meters across potentially. And we know they're there because we can see them from space. We can see the collapsed skylights, places where the roof of one of these lava tubes has collapsed. You get this tantalizing view of a rubble pile down at the bottom and like a peek down one side of the tube. But what we really want to do is explore them, find out what's going on inside of them. And not only is a place maybe we could put a future research station inside to protect astronauts from the hazards of being out in space, but also that they provide a history of both of these worlds, that you're seeing a strata of past volcanic eruptions, of old crater impacts, paleoregolith on the surface of both of these worlds. And so a lot of missions have been proposed to go directly to these lava tubes, explore their surroundings, maybe get down inside of them. And this probably is the long-term goal of a lot of the space agencies thinking right now. So my guest today is Anna Mittelholz. She's a research scientist at ETH Zurich and the principal investigator for the Lunar Leaper. And she has developed, with a bunch of her colleagues, a mission that will attempt to go to the rim of one of these open skylights on top of a lava tube and explore around. And what makes this mission a little different, it's fairly small and it uses a technology that has been developed for a while for exploring low gravity places like asteroids or the moon, a hopper. So instead of crawling around, instead of walking, you hop. And this is the kind of locomotion that the Apollo astronauts figured out pretty quickly was the best way to move around the moon. You don't try to run, you don't try to walk, you hop around. And you can actually make your way across the surface. So you have this hopping robot land relatively close to one of these skylights, and then it's able to hop around the edge of the chasm, peering over to see what's inside. Now, half of the conversation with Anna is about this, but Anna also worked on the Mars InSight mission, thinks a lot about planetary magnetospheres, especially the magnetosphere on Mars. And so I get a chance to ask one of the most commonly asked questions to me about the Mars magnetosphere. So stay tuned for that as well. All right, enjoy this interview with Anna Mittelholz. Anna, why are these skylights, these collapsed lava tubes on the moon and Mars, such an interesting place for exploration?
Yeah, good question. They are really interesting right now. You might have watched the news recently, and so you know that a lot of people, nations, but also commercial entities are trying to get back to the moon. And the overall goal for now, or like that's the next big step, is to bring people back to the moon, humans back to the moon. And if possible, have them stay on the moon for a little longer. And the moon is very uncomfortable. It is really, really cold. There are big temperature differences between day and night, like 300 degrees or so of difference. And then there's a constant micrometeor bombardment, and radiation is also, it's dangerous. And so being on the surface is not really a great idea. And so these pits, they're basically big holes in the ground. These are these really steep vertical walls, and they're thought to be collapse features. And they are thought to have collapsed in a lava tube. So the idea is there's a subsurface lava tube, and we can actually access this lava tube through these pits. And so this is one of the main reasons why they're so interesting. In terms of a future human base, these might actually be really nice and natural habitats, or like places where we can actually go into and be protected from all these, you know, dangers that would be much more intense at the surface of the moon.
Now, I've been in a few lava tubes here on Earth. I've been in Hawaii and in California, and it's an amazing experience. It's kind of like you're inside a sandworm. I don't know how to describe it, but it is like just this giant tube that with like, you know, undulating tube that you're inside of with a floor and everything. It's kind of it's an amazing experience. If I was in one of these on the moon, how would my experience be similar or different?
That's a good question, and actually a question we would like to explore further. In fact, we haven't actually seen any of those lava tubes before, but we think that they can actually grow much larger than on the Earth just because of the lower gravity. So these structures would be much more stable. They could grow much larger. So they might be, you know, hundreds of meters in diameter. Which is why they are so suitable, or possibly so suitable, for a possible base, a human base. But again, we haven't actually been able to look into any of those. So the kind of hypothesis of these, or the hypothesis that these pits are what we call skylights, so a skylight would imply that they are actually connected to a lava tube, comes from imagery, orbital imagery. And it's interesting. You can look at these early pictures, and of course, so Kaguya-Selene was the first mission with which, I think it was 2009, where it was hypothesized that actually one specific pit hole, the Marius pit, Marius Hills pit, there you go. that was the one that was hypothesized to be a skylight. And it was, so there were images taken from different angles and also different illumination angles from the sun. And it looked as if it was sort of continuing below. So there is a hint of that from the images. And so this pit hole was, of course, targeted by further missions, and lots of images were collected that kind of confirmed this observation. But it's still, it's an image, and, you know, we don't actually know how long it continues and, you know, how expansive that system is. And so, coming back to your question, I think the answer to what can we actually expect, I can give you the safest answer if you send us there and we can actually look at it. And that's what's our plan.
All right. Well, let's talk about that then. Yeah, you know, you have proposed a mission called the Lunar Leaper. What's the plan?
So yeah, our plan right now is to send this really small robot. It is a legged robot. It's actually not very big. It would probably not be much bigger than my head. I could hold it right in front of me here.
You can pick it up.
Exactly. We would like to send this robot close to one of these pit holes and have it approach it with a geophysical instrument suit. And these geophysical instrument, they would be a GPR, ground penetrating radar, and a gravimeter. And so both of these instruments are suited to detect what's in the subsurface. They can basically image the subsurface. So if there was a lava tube below them, we would be able to see it with this instrument suit. And so then we would be walking towards the hole. And at the hole, we could, you know, look at that hole in much more detail. We have a camera on board as well, of course, also for navigation purposes. So it's vital to have one of those. So we would be able to look at this in much more detail. We would continue our traverse to the other side, and hopefully actually traverse the point at which that subsurface lava tube ends. So then you would see a very big contrast where you have, you know, from hole to no hole, come back and image the other side of that hole. So that's sort of the whole mission traverse plan. The mission would last one lunar day, so we don't have that much time. That's about 12 Earth days. But we think in that time we would be able to, you know, look at the overall region and be able to, first of all, answer if there is a subsurface lava tube. That's the number one. We would then also be able to characterize its extent. We would be able to say something about, you know, this access hole, the pit hole, how's the terrain? How does it look like? Would we actually be able to access it? How stable does the structure look? Then also we have some scientific questions, of course. So these, again, there's a subsurface lava tube. So we are in a region that has been volcanically active, or was volcanically active. And so we have a really nice location at which we can study the volcanic history of the moon. And in fact, if you coming back to that initially detected Marius Hills pit, when you look from orbit, you see all these different layers along the pit wall. And these are basically different lava flows. So these are lava flows, you know, the oldest ones are the lowest ones. And then as you go higher up that stratigraphic column, basically you go younger and younger and younger. So we can almost study sort of a volcanic timeline of the moon. And then as sort of a last goal, we are interested in regolith, and that is the regolith is the subsurface materials, kind of the broken up material that we find at the surface of the moon. And that basically is formed through constant impacts from space. And so it's like this, it's grinded up. And so we're interested in the surroundings around the pit. For example, for future mission purposes, we need to know like how hard is this material? Can we move it? Can we move in it properly? What's the consistency basically? But then also along that pit wall, again, coming back to this stratigraphic column, we might actually be able to detect layers of what we would then call paleoregolith, so older regolith. Within this column, which would tell us about a time at which the volcanic activity was actually interrupted. There was a longer time at which no lava flow was just kind of, you know, adding up on top, but there was a break, which would actually be really interesting. We don't really understand the volcanic history on the moon very well.
I've read a couple of papers where people are proposing that the moon is actually one of the best time capsules of the history of the universe that we could possibly find. That if you do a core sample on the moon and analyze the regolith, you're going to see records of solar eruptions and nearby supernovae going off and the history of the moon itself, and maybe even the history of the Earth when there's various bits and pieces of the Earth splatted onto the moon. So it sounds like there's like a lot of science that could be done through this process of paleoregolith.
Yes, exactly, for sure. And this pit hole is such a unique location for that, because we have this column of all these different layers. Like we've seen it's there. We know there are multiple layers. We just don't know what they are. And if we found a paleoregolith layer, that would be a jackpot, scientifically speaking. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. So let's talk about locomotion, because you're calling it the Lunar Leaper. How will it get around? Because to see both sides of a lava tube pit is a challenge in the terrain on the moon.
Yes, absolutely. So our robot, it's actually, so I should step back here. Our Lunar Leaper robot is based on a concept that's called Space Hopper. And so Space Hopper is actually a student project. It was developed in the RSL, the Robotic System Lab at ETH. And these students came together to basically design a robot that could move in terrains, specifically on asteroids, actually, but generally low gravity terrains. And the easiest way to get around when there isn't that much that holds us to the ground is hopping. And we can actually see that looking at the old Apollo astronauts, the way they moved on the moon. They very quickly figured out that the easiest way of moving forward was hopping. That's we know all these videos of them kind of jumping around.
Sometimes falling over. Yeah.
No, exactly. It's not that easy. And so yeah, that was one of the inspirations. And so that was the whole idea in mind when they started working on this. And so now we're building upon their work, and we're developing this asteroid hopper to be a lunar leaper. So to hop on the moon again, we think this is actually the most efficient way of moving. And also, it is likely the more safe way of moving. Like we know from all the rovers on Mars, for example, they are very limited in where they can actually go. Like you cannot go in terrains that is too steep, where the where it's too the material is too loose or so. And these are all obstacles that, you know, it's not a problem for our legged hopping robot, basically. And so we really think that this legged technology is one that, especially for the moon, could be really, really well suited.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, you're saying this after two previous lunar landers have failed to land properly face up. So you've got the Slim lander that landed upside down. You've got the Odysseus lander that probably broke one of its legs and fell over sideways onto the moon. So it's definitely not super safe. I mean, landing on the moon the first time and then doing it again, hopefully multiple times. How many hops are you hoping to make?
I mean, so our general way of moving forward is sort of a hopping motion. So that's kind of it. That's our walking. And the good thing, actually, so our robot.
I want to understand this. How far will you, like, so you talk about this, that you're moving forward by hopping. So, like, how far will each hop be? Just a few meters? Or will you hop from where you started to where you want to go next?
So maybe, okay, sorry, maybe this wasn't actually clear. So we are actually trying on moving for quite a distance. So our total distance that we would like to traverse is approximately 1 kilometer. So that's how far we need to hop. how large these hops, like each individual one, how large they have to be is actually something that we're figuring out right now. And there's certainly a sweet spot in, you know, how much energy do we use per hop? How efficient is it? And this is something we're currently in a phase where we're looking into feasibility, where we're looking into each of these different components. And that's something that we need to address. So I can't actually give you an exact answer right now.
Is it a purely propulsive hop? Or is it some kind of mechanical action like a grasshopper?
So we have these little motors at each of the joints, and the movement is, so we're pushing away from the ground, and this is our way of getting forward, moving forward. So instead of having tires and rolling like a rover, we are just moving slightly differently.
I understand. Okay. So you're not like with a thruster lifting off, hopping to a new location, landing again. You're using electricity to power these motors, and you've got this kicking motion.
Yes.
And the thing is hopping around instead of rolling, instead of some other method of locomotion. It's just this, this over and over again. So you'll know very quickly, right, how this is going to work. Understood. Okay. So, you know, you talk about how you think this is a much better method. I mean, have we seen this tested? We haven't seen this tested in any spacecraft yet, have we? I mean, I guess some of the Japanese stuff has been kind of close, but...
Well, so there are no legged robots that have been used anywhere on another planet so far. We have, I don't know so the robotic system lab, the lab we've been pairing up with, the ones that are developing our robot, they are, so their field of research is autonomous robotics. And they have been working on this little robot that you might have seen before. It looks a little bit like a dog. They call it Animal. Also Boston Robotics develops them.
Sure.
They are being used on Earth. And, you know, any place that we don't want to go to, it might be somewhere underground, but it might also just be in some area where there was an earthquake or some construction sites, any places that might be dangerous. These legged robots are starting to find use. They're, and obviously, I already said places where we might not want to be as humans. And that is obviously also true for planetary exploration. Not that we don't want to be there, but, you know, as sending a robot like that for a first scouting mission before we end up going there, that's the idea.
Right. So then what is the sort of state of the project right now? You had delivered a presentation at the recent planetary science meeting, and mm-hmm. and I had sort of, that's where I first sort of noticed the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there's been some other press releases and stuff put out as well. Where are you along the process right now? Who are you proposing this to?
Mm-hmm. So there was an ESA call, so the European Space Agency. They were looking for small lunar missions. So small in terms of budget, but also in terms of timing. So this is supposed to be a mission that should go to the moon within 4.5 years. So very fast for a planetary exploration mission. And they were very broadly looking for anything that might be of interest on the moon. And this is the call we proposed to. And the deadline for that was last year in, I think, November, end of November. And so the idea back then was to really just kind of come up with, they call it an idea. So it's quite clear. This is the mission, and you obviously provide some technical details, but you don't have to go in all the details at that point. And so around 70 proposals were submitted at that point. And what is it, 20th of May? So on May 1st, so not too long ago, we actually heard back from ESA that our call or our proposal was selected for the next phase. So we are really, really happy that this first step worked out. There hasn't been an official announcement. We just know that we can now work on the next step, which is going to be pre-phase A. And that basically means we are now in a stage in which we have to go into much more detail. We have to show that what we're proposing is actually possible, that, you know, the goals we have can be answered with the instruments we're bringing, and that we can actually, you know, power these instruments given what our solar panels can generate and so on. So just give a much more, do a feasibility study. That's basically the next step. And that's going to start in June.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Yeah, I do a lot of interviews with people who have won the NASA NIAC Awards. I don't know if you're familiar with them, the Advanced Innovative Concepts. They sort of similar thing. They award people for very cutting edge ideas and then help them refine them over the years. But ESA has this completely separate program. They have their Cosmic Visions program. And as you said, these various ones that come up where they're like, any idea, we want to hear anything, no matter how out there that it is, that can solve some of these science goals that we have. And they're mm-hmm. as interesting and as fascinating. In some cases, there's crossover where the same idea is proposed to both ESA and NASA at various points. And so I mm-hmm. really enjoy reading through these calls for proposals and some of the ideas as they come out. So analyzing the sides and peering over the edge of a crater, of a pit on the moon would be amazing, but even more amazing would be to get down into a lava tube and actually explore it from beneath. Yes. So have you spent any time sort of thinking about what would be involved to try to actually explore one of these from inside?
Definitely. And I mean, that would obviously be really cool. So one of the kind of logistical things you would have to keep in mind is that we would still have to somehow communicate with a lander. So the way, maybe just quickly, the way to get to the moon would be with some lander that we haven't actually defined a specific one that we would then be able to communicate with, and that and that lander would then communicate our data with some satellite or the Earth. And that requires line of sight. So we need to be able to actually see our lander to some degree. And so jumping into the hole that would obviously complicate that situation by quite a bit. And this is why, for now, we have not proposed this. We do highlight, though, that this might be something we could do, especially if you think about... So one of the big advantages that I didn't actually mention earlier was that our robot is really light. Well, I said it was very small, but it's also really light, which... I say advantage because you can actually, it's very cheap to send it anywhere because, you know, you can carry a given payload and everyone kind of pays their contribution to getting their mission up. But that would also mean that we would never be the only mission to be brought to the moon. You know, we expect that there would be multiple missions on that same lander. So maybe there's a possibility at some point to team up with some other mission that we would be able to communicate with or something, you know, something like that. This is not part of the concept we're introducing right now or of the concept we're proposing because it's something that we can't actually, you know, evaluate or we don't have all the details to actually get there. And we think we can answer important questions without jumping in. But as you said, jumping in would be quite the extra bit. And we know, or
right. we're not part. Like yeah, just exactly. As the sun is going down.
The grand finale.
One last exactly. Leap exactly. Off the edge. Yeah. Yeah. Over the edge.
We're likely not going to survive the night anyways, right? And so this final jump, if we die anyways, you know, it's maybe not even that big a risk either. So as long as we can communicate, and even if we, you know, don't survive the fall, that would be fine.
Right. Well, but it might even be more protected down in the lava tube. It's more protected from the temperatures. And so, in fact, that might be the way to save the mission is to get down out of the, you know, the extreme temperature changes. And it might be the way. Yeah. I love that idea. Now, most of your work as a scientist is thinking about Mars. And you worked on the InSight mission. But I would love to know, these same things, these collapsed lava tube roofs are on Mars as well. But then we saw the success of the Ingenuity helicopter. We know that helicopters work well on Mars. Would your idea hold a candle to just flying a helicopter around the edge of a lava tube and down inside of it?
I mean, that would be amazing. I guess it... on the moon, there is probably not quite enough atmosphere that we can do that. We know we can do it on Mars. The only thing we would have to consider, the only thing we have to consider is powering it. You know, anything that has to do with solar panels underground does not work so well. But if we could power it, I mean, that would be amazing. We would actually be able to get in there. So, yeah. For sure, that
like would be return an option. to the opening mm-hmm. after every flight or something. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. If that works, if you can always recharge and then you go back in and then you come back out, recharge. Maybe that could work. Yeah, and I mean for Mars, it's sort of the same idea as for the moon, right? When I mentioned earlier, the ultimate goal is to get to the moon. That's not quite true. The ultimate goal is actually to get to Mars, right? One of the reasons to go to the moon is that if we could start from the moon instead of starting from the Earth, given the moon's lower gravity, we can actually get out into the outer solar system much easier, and we could get out to Mars much easier to, for example, bring humans to the surface of the moon. And again, we would have these lava tunnels as a possible site for a suitable base. So same exploration background in some ways. Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, Mars has more gravity, 1/3 Earth gravity instead of 1/6, but also has really complicated terrain, places that the existing rovers just aren't able to pass through. Do you think this hopping technique might work well on Mars as well?
Definitely. I mean, a legged robot in general, it doesn't necessarily have to hop either. So I think that the legged system in terms of, you know, what we can traverse and what we can traverse is advantageous. The question on if it would do more of a walking or a hopping movement, that would probably have to be determined, you know, what is the most suitable also for a given terrain or so.
I think about like jumping spiders, you know, that we've got them around and inside the house often, and they'll crawl around very carefully spider-like, and then they will leap really far and land somewhere and then keep moving. And so maybe that's the combo is something that is like a jumping spider on Mars.
Yeah, right. Right. It actually, I have had people comment that our robot looks a little bit like a jumping spider. So, you know, that's not so far off.
Yeah. Walk when it needs to and then jump when it needs to cross some kind of gap or something. I love it.
Exactly.
I love spiders, so this does not bother me at all.
Perfect.
I want to shift gears now. We've talked about the mission. Good luck with that. But thanks. Your research work has largely been in studying planetary magnetospheres, specifically Mars. And so one of the big questions that everybody has is, why does Mars not have a global magnetosphere the way the Earth does?
Yeah, Mars is complicated. So Mars does have a magnetosphere, an induced magnetosphere, but it doesn't have a global dynamo field. So that's the big missing part. So for the Earth, we all know we have that big global dynamo field that's being generated within the core. And being generated within the core because we have some liquid iron that's convecting. So what we know about Mars is that this is likely not happening, or it's not convecting vigorously enough to be able to sustain a dynamo. And why that is? So, I mean, there are sort of different ideas. Mars is much smaller than the Earth, so it cools down quicker. And so we might just not have, it might just not be hot enough anymore. We know actually from InSight and also from measurements in space, InSight, a NASA mission to Mars, by the way, that operated just the last few years. It had a seismometer on board. And with this seismometer, we detected that there was indeed a liquid core. So we know that there is this molten metallic material. So we know it's there. But again, it's apparently not convecting vigorously enough. One other aspect actually we were able to find with InSight, which is also very interesting, is that Mars likely does not have an inner solid core as opposed to the Earth. And for the Earth, this solid inner core is actually important for a magnetic field generation. Because basically, constantly, we are having this liquid material in the interior of the Earth crystallizing to form a solid bit in the interior. And that releases energy. And that actually contributes to generating this convecting motion in that dynamo field. And so again, Mars does not have one of these solid inner cores. So that might be one of the contributors that there isn't a dynamo being generated anymore. We know that there was a dynamo at some point in time, like approximately 4 billion years ago, so a very long time ago. And we know this because we have rocks at the surface of Mars, so the crustal material that is really quite strongly magnetized. And the only explanation for that, the only way to actually magnetize that crust would be through a dynamo. And so this is kind of, that's the ancient record of Mars's past. And maybe it was just much hotter back then and it was able to sustain the dynamo. And then after cooling down, the dynamo died and that was it. That's a possible explanation, but we don't exactly know.
Now, you said that it has an induced magnetic field. So would you characterize that?
Yeah. So basically, a magnetosphere is not necessarily just a dynamo field. It is the way a planet interacts with the magnetic field that's being produced or that's coming from the sun, the interplanetary magnetic field. And so the sun with its solar wind, it will impinge onto a planet. And for example, on the moon does not have a magnetosphere. The solar wind literally just, you know, impacts the body itself. And so there's no magnetosphere. For Mars, that's not quite the case. So Mars has a little bit of an atmosphere, and the solar wind interaction with that atmosphere builds up what we call an ionosphere. So that's and what happens at that, it basically creates a boundary where the solar wind is decelerated really, really quickly. And sort of the, if you look at a magnetic field coming from the sun, it basically just drapes around the planet, similar to what we see on the Earth. Just for the Earth, this field that sort of holds back the sun's, the solar wind, the sun's magnetic field is that dynamo. It's much stronger than the ionosphere for the Earth's case. So that's much more important. And so that's why for Mars, we call this induced magnetosphere, because the magnetosphere that holds, holds back the solar wind is induced in the ionosphere. So there are currents that are being produced there.
But that's not providing any protection from cosmic rays.
It is, to some degree. It is generating protection more so than for the moon, for example. Actually, also interesting for Mars is we have, I mentioned these really strong crustal fields in some places. And so what happens at these places, the crustal fields are quite strong. So what they build up is these, they call them mini magnetosphere. So they basically, you can think of them as like little field lines that build little protective houses that hold back cosmic radiation, that hold back solar wind. And so this is sort of the special case and what differentiates Mars from Venus in this sort of, from the point of view of understanding magnetospheres. It's quite interesting.
I get this question all the time from my audience, and it usually starts with someone saying, why don't they just, and I know, okay, here comes some giant engineering project, and then propose crashing various things into Mars to restart its magnetic field. I guess one, would crashing something large into Mars, I don't know, like Titan, or something, help restart its magnetic field? So is this even feasible?
So what do you need? you need convection within the interior. That's easiest if you have a big temperature gradient. So the interior has to be really hot, and as you go further out, it's colder, so that you know the hot material rises. If you crush something very big into Mars, you would certainly do something to its thermal state. You would probably melt quite a bit of it. Who knows? Maybe. And actually for Mars's past, so Mars has a very funny shape. I don't know if you know this. It has a very, the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere look quite different. The southern hemisphere is much thicker, has a much higher altitude than the northern hemisphere. And one of the hypotheses is that an impactor produced that signature. And so that could be your, what was it, Titan impacting Mars? And it has actually been proposed that at least it affected the magnetic field. I don't know. I mean, you know, if we would have to run some dyno models and see what we can do with this temperature differences to actually start one. But if we just crush little things into Mars, I do not expect a magnetic field to start. And, you know, this whole, the core drilling down, you know, on Earth, what I think the deepest borehole is, what, 13 kilometers or so? We have a radius of 6,371 kilometers. You know, it's a fraction. We don't get very far. And then our equipment starts melting. We're sort of going sideways suddenly. So, yeah, it's not that easy.
Right. So maybe instead put a meter of regolith between you and space and don't worry about the problem anymore.
That seems much easier.
So, Anna, what are you obsessed with right now?
Okay, I'll give you two answers. I'll give you my science answer and my non-science answer. My science answer is sticking with my magnetic field obsession, I think it is really interesting that if we look at the different planets in our solar system, not just planets, also moons in our solar system, and even just the terrestrial ones, if we look into, you know, which of them has magnetized crust, which of them has an ionosphere, which of them has a dynamo field, these different compositions that make up a magnetic field environment, each body is different. Each, and it's kind of crazy. And I would say that the question I'm sort of obsessed with, and I know it's a little bit of a large scale question, I would like to know how every single of these bodies got to the point they are now. Like, how did Mars end up with a strongly magnetized crust, no dynamo, an ionosphere, you know, the, kind of the state at which we can observe them now? I think that's my science obsession.
And I mean, when you think about Venus, right? Venus is the same size and mass as Earth, and yet doesn't have a dynamo in the same way that Earth does, doesn't have plate tectonics that the way that we do. Like, you couldn't have set up the conditions for to have a twin more carefully, and yet we don't have a twin. That's got to be keeping planetary scientists up at night.
Why? We have this hugely dense atmosphere and its ionosphere. No dynamo and no indication that there was a dynamo at any point. Actually, from all the terrestrial planets, Venus is the only one we have not detected magnetized crust. To be fair, Venus has very young crust. So the surface is very young. So maybe, you know, it was actually magnetized at some point, and it's just because of resurfacing and reheating, it lost these signatures. But still, it's quite interesting that there's really no indication of anything in terms of a dynamo now or in the past. I agree. Yeah, I don't know.
And it feels like we are going to need exoplanets to answer this question, that only by observing enough exoplanets in the radio wave, detecting the auroras coming from the magnetospheres, getting a sense of how many exoplanets out there do have global magnetospheres, will we be able, like, maybe Earth is the only one in the universe, which seems unlikely, but still. And maybe we're going to find they're all over the place, and it makes a lot more sense. So I feel like exoplanets are probably the where the answer will be found.
It's a rising field, and more people interested in it. I think in terms of magnetic research, it's still at the very beginning. But in a way, just looking at, you know, how does atmosphere escape from a given planet gives you information on the geometry of that field. You know, we know that if we have a dynamo field, most of the atmosphere would escape at the poles following the field lines. If we don't have that, that's not the case. Like for Mars has very different atmospheric escape channels. And this very interesting connection of atmosphere and magnetic field. Do we need a magnetic field to keep an atmosphere? Venus would say no, you know? So this is actually another, there's another question that's linked to this that I think maybe exoplanets are the solution or will provide the answer, because we are limited in with our few planets that we have in our solar system. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And your non-science obsession right now?
My non-science obsession. I love climbing. I'm a big, that's my big hobby here on Earth. And so that's how I keep my connection to Earth, in being outside and enjoying rock around me. That's my non-science obsession.
Yeah. Well, you spent all this time here in British Columbia going to UBC. I'm sure you spent some time at Squamish and Whistler and getting a chance to get outdoors here. I mean, that's I take 2 months off of like July and August every year. Mm-hmm. And then all I do is spend my time outside. It's such a wonderful part of the world to be able to do that.
Definitely. Squamish. I think I actually dedicated my thesis to the chief in Squamish for keeping me sane.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. For those who don't know, you may Google it or whatever. It's this gigantic granite mountain here near just outside of Vancouver. And there's the hard way, which is climbing up the face of the chief. And then there's the easy way. There's a nice trail that you can follow up the backside and step out on the top and get the same view, which I've done several times. And it's great. I haven't done I haven't tried the face. That sounds hard. Well, and it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Good luck with project. And hopefully we'll talk next after you've come back from the moon.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good plan. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Anna Minholtz. I'm going to sort of talk more about Lavatubes in a second. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Dennis Alberti, Dougie Stewart, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Mark Ansis, Modso, Paul Rohrbach, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. Well, as you probably know, I am utterly obsessed with these Lavatubes on the moon and Mars, and I've talked to many people about what it's going to take to be able to investigate them. We've written tons of stories on Universe Today about this. Anytime anybody brings up any proposal to figure out a way to explore the insides of these Lavatubes, we're all over it. And there are so many scientific questions that can be answered. I mean, you've got this geologic history that is in this safe environment, comparatively safe anyway, for the rest of the planet, that you could go down into and you could be protected at the same time that you are exploring this history on both the moon and Mars. And like, what else could you hope for? I mean, the conditions could be mild for through the lunar day and into the lunar night. It could be mild through the Martian day and the Martian night, and you're protected from the radiation. And yet there are these unique challenges to being able to go there. You're away from the sunlight. You're away from direct communications with Earth. And so these are the kinds of challenges that need to be overcome. And yet if they can be, then they are the perfect places to explore. Now, I did an interview with a cave explorer here on Earth who thinks about what it's going to take to actually send astronauts to explore caves on the moon or Mars. So check that interview out now. All right. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time.